Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 14, 2016. A senior church leader says hundreds of Yei Town residents were forced to leave their homes at gunpoint.
They are under this mango tree, almost having nothing to eat. I am very, very worried. We've been calling for support. People think we are joking. And there are no NGOs here that have the capacity of helping these people.
And South Sudan National Security Operatives closed down a newspaper in Juba for publishing opinion on the Sentry investigative report.
We published actually an opinion. They say it tarnished the image of the national security. So they asked us to produce the opinion writer. We told them we are not able to produce the opinion writer.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We first go to Jonglei, where a South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission official says aid agencies should provide urgent food assistance to nearly 8,000 internally displaced persons in Duke County. The Jonglei State Director for the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is also asking aid agencies to provide non-food items such as blankets and medicine to IDPs. A WFP spokesperson says heavy rains and other logistical challenges are making it difficult for his agency to deliver food aid to IDPs. Jacob Achek has more for VOA from Juba.
Last month, more than 7,000 people fled their homes in the Fajut area of Panyang County when violence erupted between government soldiers and suspected SPLA-IO forces. The IDPs sought refuge in Foktap, Padiet, and Duk Kwayuel area of the county. The director of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, Gabriel Deng Ajak, says aid workers who recently assessed the need of the IDPs identified food as a top priority.
The 7,000 IDPs that are currently in Foktap have no food, but the WFP say they have no air access to at least food to Foktap. So I really do not understand as to why they say they don't have an aircraft when they have an aircraft dropping in other areas.
WFP spokesperson in South Sudan, George Pomian, says heavy rain in Jonglei State have made it impossible for humanitarian workers to reach the area by road. Pomian says logistical problems had also caused delays. He says the WFP will use aircraft to deliver food to IDPs living in Duke County.
There are many people in many different parts of South Sudan, not only in the greater Jonglei area, who are in need of assistance. We are working towards how we can provide assistance to them with the means which we have at our disposal at this time.
The spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNOCHA in South Sudan, says aid workers assess the need of the 8,000 IDPs in Foktap, Fayuel, and Padiet Payam in Duke County. Guimar Fausula says aid agencies have already delivered non-food items to the IDPs and plan to deliver food as soon as possible.
The humanitarians were able to deliver the first assistance there, so they delivered some basic household items like kitchen items, plastic sheets, some sleeping mats, blankets, and also some shelter materials to the IDPs. There are so many emergencies around the country, and the agencies have to deliver assistance to many places, but this is planned, so as soon as it's possible, they will deliver food.
Pomian says the WFP delivered food to those in need across South Sudan as long as the area are accessible by road or air. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
Meanwhile, in Yei, the bishop of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan says at least 400 families were forced out of their homes over the weekend by men in military uniforms. Right Reverend Hilary Luate Adeba says the armed men went on rampage, shooting at residents and destroying and looting houses after unknown gunmen killed a security officer attached to the governor's office. About 6 million people in South Africa are living with HIV/AIDS. Many of them also live with moderate to severely chronic pain. A new study says, despite the pain, they are surprisingly active for reasons that have nothing to do with health. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Headache, chest pain, and nerve pain are some of the common complaints of those with HIV/AIDS. Dr. Antonia Wadley is studying the effects of this. She's with the Brain Function Research Group at Wits University in Johannesburg.
It's actually been an area of research for our research group for quite a few years now, and we've noticed with some of our other studies actually what a high burden of pain there is in the HIV population. But what we saw more recently was that it wasn't quite clear how much people were affected by their pain. And when I say affected, I mean how much pain they have with their day-to-day activities.
And the ailments are the same, whether or not they're receiving ARVs, antiretroviral drugs.
Treating the HIV doesn't treat the pain. Yeah, that is one of the myths out there, that once people are on ARVs, they're all good, but actually there's still a huge burden of pain, even when people are being treated.
Wadley says pain is chronic when it's present most days for at least 3 months. Nevertheless, it did not make HIV-positive people in South Africa sedentary. Instead, she says, they were surprisingly active.
You can imagine if you hurt your back or you've got leg pain, you'd move a bit less. But when we measured activity objectively, actually we found that activity was exactly the same in people with chronic pain and without. And we looked at the activity in a number of ways, and we still didn't find any difference, which really surprised us.
At first, researchers simply thought of them as being resilient, able to cope with adversity. But there was a lot more to it than that.
We looked at what patients worried about, and we found that patients in pain worried about everything more than patients not in pain. You know, they worried about money more and having enough food, and they worried about their health least of all. So the hypothesis that we're kind of running with is that actually economic stresses might force people to be more active.
Dr. Wadley says they found a second reason why those with HIV/AIDS are active despite pain.
I happened to be asking patients what else they worried about and who they'd told about their pain. And it transpired that a large proportion of them hadn't told even their closest friends or their family about their chronic pain because they feared that it would reveal their HIV status. So it's possible that HIV stigma might be also driving people to be more active just so they can look like they're healthy.
The idea that HIV stigma could affect how one reacts to pain was new. Wadley says further study is needed.
3 decades ago, when somebody received a diagnosis of HIV, it was a death sentence. And now with good ARV therapy, they can live near to normal life expectancy. So it's really important that the quality of that extra life is good.
She says that it really does appear that if you are poor, pain may be relegated to a lower priority because you worry more about having enough to eat or being shunned. The findings have been published in the journal Peer. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Still on health matters, a new study highlights the risk of spread of malaria around dams and reservoirs in sub-Saharan Africa. The report shows the number of infected people living in this part of Africa will nearly double to around 25 million by the year 2080. The research was conducted by International Water Management Institute, or IWMI, and a global AG research agency. Their findings were published in the September issue of Malaria Journal in South Africa. Jonathan Lutz, senior researcher for the IWMI, tells VOA's Kim Lewis about the implications of their findings.
We have done past research that was published last year assessing the level of malaria transmission around dams now, and we found about 1.1 million cases associated with dams each year. And looking to the future is what we focused on this year. And to look to the future in these days, you need to incorporate impacts of climate change. So we looked to the future and focused on 2 decades broadly, the 2050s and the 2080s. And we found that malaria transmission around dams in Africa will increase from its current level, which I just said is about 1.1 million cases each year, to about 2.1 to 3 million cases in the 2050s, and then up towards a range of 2.4 to 3 million cases each year in the 2080s.
What are some examples of climate impacts that will be affecting people or the area?
There's multiple ways that climate change will affect malaria transmission, and then in particular, malaria transmission around dams. Broadly, the mosquito breeding cycle accelerates under warmer temperatures. With climate change, we're going to transition towards higher temperatures, so that process will accelerate. So you have more mosquitoes passing through their larval stages more quickly to adult stages, producing more larvae, and then the end result is a greater number of mosquitoes. And then the thing is, with dams, you have just standing bodies of water there that are just, you know, ideal sites for larvae and then ultimately mosquitoes to develop themselves. That's part of it. Another part is that the zones of malaria transmission will actually expand. So there's varying perceptions of Africa and that malaria is transmitted everywhere and whatnot. It's actually not. There are portions of Africa where you don't have malaria transmission. So in particular, in the East African highlands, like in Kenya and Ethiopia, currently, there's decent portions of those countries where malaria is not transmitted. Similarly, in southern Africa, Zimbabwe, in the water, South Africa, parts of Botswana and Namibia, you don't have malaria transmission. So generally, the climate is not suitable to facilitate the development of the mosquitoes that can transmit the disease. So with global warming as part of climate change, and there's more impacts to climate change than just warming. There's also changing rainfall patterns. In terms of the warming aspect of it, warming temperatures will make different areas more effectively suitable where they're not currently to mosquito development that will enable disease to be transmitted. I highlighted earlier those greater numbers in terms of malaria transmission, in terms of doubling to tripling by the 2080s. We said, okay, where are the hot spots for the impact? Where is it most acutely going to be felt? It's actually in some of these areas that malaria is expected to expand to where it's currently not transmitted.
The challenge then is going to be, how is the malaria risk going to be taken into consideration along with the technology of building new dams or changing the environment and climate change impacting all of that at the same time? That's quite a lot to deal with. And how do you think this is going to be handled?
This is in no way to say anything that dam building should stop. Usually the benefits are far greater than these externalities or unintended consequences or costs. Dam building is key. And if you look at Africa compared to some other regions, the level of water storage behind dams is actually quite low. So there is a need to increase resilience, to improve food security through dam building. Now, in terms of what can be done, there's a lot. Commonly now, there's environmental impact assessments or health impact assessments that generally identify malaria risk. I'll emphasize that word generally. I think there's a lot more that can be done in terms of drilling down and predicting the adverse malaria consequences associated with a set of site-specific variables. For example, slope. You know, slope around the edge of a reservoir can make a dam and the reservoir behind it less suitable to transmission. These things are commonly not factored into assessments that are done. Also, in terms of the climate change aspect, you can look forward. So you can do a health or environmental impact assessment that doesn't just assess degree of risk today, but also thinks, okay, by the 2050s or 2080s or, you know, whichever time step you choose, given the changing temperatures and other changes that are likely to occur, how might those affect risk of transmission around the reservoir? So it's not just about assessing risk now. It's about looking to the future.
That's Jonathan Lutz, a senior researcher for the International Water Management Institute. He was speaking to VOA's Kim Lewis from Johannesburg, South Africa. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, lawmakers in South Sudan are demanding back pay. We will tell you why after this break.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you love most about your family?
The closeness that we have in the family. We are always together. Whenever there is a problem, we come together and handle it together. Each time we have a function, we come together. We are very supportive of each other.
What I love from my family, they are so caring for me. See, I've came to Uganda because of my family. They helped me a lot to pay my school fees, caring for my personal properties. Like, they pay me some cash pocket money to help me.
Well, it's the love and the support. Firstly, the love, because they raised me, basically, and they've been giving me all that I need. You know, they've been there from the start. You know, since from education, they've been helping me out.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. We now have the tape on our stories in Yei. The bishop of the Episcopal Church of Sudan in South Sudan in Yei River State says at least 400 families were forced out of their homes over the weekend by armed men in military uniforms. Right Reverend Hilary Luate Adeba says the armed men went on rampage, shooting at residents and destroying and looting their houses after unknown gunmen killed a security officer attached to governor's office. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Residents of Yei town say they heard sporadic gunshots over the weekend at Lutaya, Haidem and Sopri residential areas. Perez Kade was displaced along with her 8 children. She says the latest upsurge of violence in Yei town has caused more panic in the town. Speaking in her native Kakwa language, Kade says soldiers in uniform forced residents out of their homes for no apparent reason.
We are now here. We left our homes last Saturday. We were staying and saw people wearing military uniforms, and we don't know whether they are government soldiers or rebel groups. They just told us to leave our homes. On Sunday, when we went for prayers, there were sporadic gunshots. How can we stay with our children because of this? Until yesterday, the situation was not good.
Scopus Wani is a sub-chief of Sopri village. He confirms residents were forced out of their homes by armed men believed to belong to the South Sudan Army.
The houses were destroyed and we were chased here to our father bishop. So what can we do? Let them give us a place to stay safe. Now the soldiers and the dogs are the one happy with our food. They ate our chicken and everything. Now the children are with us here, and they say we need not to go to collect our properties. We don't want you an item, but if we cultivate, they chase us.
The spokesman for the South Sudan Army, Brigadier Lulroy Kong, says his office has no information on the violence in Yei River State over the weekend. Most of the displaced residents are now sheltering at the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan compound in Yei. Right Reverend Hilary Luate Adeba is the bishop of the diocese. He says the church does not have enough food to feed all the internal displaced persons at the church compound.
They were forced out of their livelihood, and now they are under this mango tree, almost having nothing to eat. I am very, very worried. We've been calling for support. People think we are joking. And there are no NGOs here that have the capacity of helping these people. The UN are here. I don't know what they are seeing. I can see a UN car here. I don't know why they have come here. So we are really helpless, and there is nothing I can do with these people.
This marks the 5th month since fighting broke out in Yei River State. Bishop Adeba says thousands of residents are hiding in the bush with no access to food, water, or health care. He says others fled to neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo for safety.
The most immediate thing I am asking from people who can help us is food and water and places of residence under the mango trees right from now here. We have very inadequate facilities. Our toilet facilities are meant for a few people. But now we have thousands of them are here. I don't know what I can do. The NGOs that are to help people are not here. The roads are closed.
Attempts to reach municipal authorities for comments on this story were unsuccessful. Last week, the state governor of Yei River State, David Lokonga, admitted for the first time that there is rampant insecurity along the roads leading in and out of Yei, and that humanitarian conditions of citizens in the state have continued to deteriorate. International aid workers have urged the state officials to guarantee the safety of aid workers before they can provide additional services in the Yei River State. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
dozens of South Sudanese lawmakers who lost their seats after joining the armed opposition led by former first Vice President Riek Machar are requesting back salaries for several months. The lawmakers were reinstated earlier this year in accordance with the August 2015 peace agreement. Deputy Speaker of the Transitional National Assembly, Timothy Chol, says Parliament has yet to decide whether to honour their requests. Waki Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
Most of the 26 MPs demanding back pay were sacked in August 2014 by a parliamentary resolution after they joined the SPLMIO. Three other lawmakers were sacked from Parliament in April of this year for being absent for too long. The lawmakers were reinstated per the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan, wanted the government to pay back their salaries plus benefits for the duration of time they were away. Reverend Matthew Mathiang, who represented the Koch and Gwit counties of former Unity State in the National Assembly before the outbreak of fighting in December 2013, says he left Juba in 2014 for medical treatment and later joined the SPLMIO. Mathiang says he was fired for being absent in April, shortly before the formation of the transitional government of national unity. Mathiang insists he received permission from the leadership of a national assembly before leaving the country.
All of us were reinstated, but they are trying to deny us all right, the money. But mine in particular must be paid. I can go to the court with it. This is my right.
Borgat Wichkwani, another lawmaker who was sacked but later reinstated, is demanding payment for at least 8 months. Kwani, who also serves as the SPLMIO chief whip in the National Assembly, says he was unseated from Parliament in August 2014 after he joined the empty opposition. He says the MPs claiming pay also include some SPLM leaders commonly referred to as former detainees because they were detained following the outbreak of violence in December 2013. When the MPs raised the issue with the Parliament's Assembly Committee, other lawmakers decided that the MPs had the right to be paid back their salaries and benefits. Kwani says leaders in Parliament are dragging their feet over the matter.
The leadership is skeptical, I think, not because of political reason, but because of economic crisis that the country is in at the moment.
Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly, Timothy Chol, says the MPs were suspended because they had violated the Business Code of Conduct, which empowers the Parliament to suspend or dismiss a lawmaker after missing several parliamentary sessions. Chol says some lawmakers fled the country during the 2013 crisis, fearing for their lives. He says Parliament must address the lawmakers' demands.
Nobody said that if these MPs have a rightful claim, it will not be given to them, but it will be investigated.
Chol says the government will determine how many lawmakers are affected and how much money they are claiming.
It is an issue that will need further investigation. And as the first deputy speaker of the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, with the permission of the speaker, I will try to investigate this and find out what is the truth about this. Of course, those who joined the rebel movement and were suspended have no case. But those who went on permissions from the House and decided to rejoin the rebel movement and are reinstated, their complaint will be reviewed.
Besides salaries, the lawmakers are also demanding clothing and medical allowances for the period they were away. Each member of the National Assembly received a total monthly pay of slightly more than 11,500 South Sudanese pounds, equivalent to $160, which includes allowances. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still in Juba, South Sudan's National Security Agency ordered the Juba-based Nation Mirror newspaper to close down indefinitely for publishing an article about the Sentry's two-year probe that accused government and military leaders of enriching themselves while citizens suffer. Mirror editor Aurelio Simon Choptek says the security officers offered no explanation for shutting down the paper. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Chopek says national security officials summoned the paper's editor to their office today in Juba, where security officials shown them a letter ordering the paper's closure.
They have not cited any reason, only what we read from the order. The order, which was not even given to us so that we could take it to the office, the order only remained with them. And they only said, we have indulged in activities. They are saying we have gone out of our mandate.
It is believed the Nation Mirror was closed after publishing a headline that read, Kiir, Machar, top generals implicated in Century Corruption Report. Chopek says every citizen has a constitutional right to express an opinion without any interference.
We published actually an opinion. They say it tarnished the image of the national security. So they asked us to produce the opinion writer. We told them we are not able to produce the opinion writer. Of course, we in the Nation Mirror do welcome opinions from every South Sudanese.
Alfred Taban, chairman of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, says he was shocked to hear the news of the newspaper's closure. Taban says association officials will contact the National Security Service officials in the coming days to ensure that the paper is allowed to reopen.
At Amdis, we have written to the media authority, bringing to their attention the fact that the security has been arresting journalists and confiscating newspapers, and now they have closed down a media house.
Both Taban and Chopek say if there is any unlawful act committed by any media house or journalist, the National Security Service officers should follow the law. In February 2015, National Security Service officials closed the same newspaper for more than 8 months. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
That report by Michael Atit in Juba brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Sudan by Panda by S.O.B.
Yeah, S.O.B. only. No, I know you feel the same thing I felt for Sudan. Yeah, S.O.B. in the hood. Yeah.
Sudan by Panda.
My homeland, S-U-D-A-N, Sudan is the biggest, smallest, greatest, poorest, richest, like a young, beautiful African girl, fell in love with hydra-headed leaders, shielded by fame and ambitions, ripped by petroleum and religions, and forsaken by all, with the exception of jungle boys, Tunase, Akhe, Kise, Lafe, Bera.
Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, who palgeting a party, who palgeting a party, who came by Panda, oh. Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, who palgeting a party, who palgeting a party, who came by Panda, oh.
Tell her, Quarry Monk, or tell no win more chamber. Nyoko kwa Afrika, kwa chano bu Afrika temal. Nyoko kwa Sudan, kwa ya no bu Sudan temal. Matke na matke mon, heran gore je. Matke na matke Afrika, heran gore je. Matke na matke Sudan, kon gona je. Gona matke gona mal. Ye trong na da run na ma kam dun ye na jesku. Kam dun ye na jima aradu. Mani kam dun ye na jisya kadu. Me wana temal. Heran der we chilore tes. Oko kwa na benke. Han haran malancha. Han naga Kamal guru din chim kamal charan luro kamal mi wala jal goli e poch ko war ka kon konum na dom so go do mal mi chana mat ka te mi kon la na je ke jo mi di mal.
We've been listening to a group calling itself SOB with the song Sudan by Panda. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Yeah.